Good evening. This is Life Rattle, the story show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1249, we continue our showcase of stories written and read by Virginia Ashbery. Virginia Ashbery was born in Toronto in 1952, the youngest of three children. She left home at 17, married on her 19th birthday, and had three children. She left her husband, took the kids when they were 8, 6, and 3 years old, and went to live in Peterborough on mother's allowance, where she went to university. In 1985, Ashbery sold everything she had and drove the three kids across Canada to Victoria, BC. She returned 6 weeks later to face the issues she realized she'd run away from. "Things were difficult until I was 40," Ashbery says, "but now they're better." This year, Virginia Ashbery moved to Hamilton, Ontario. Early every morning, she commutes to Toronto, where she has worked in social services since 1991. Watch for a collection of stories by Ashbery to be published by Life Rattle Press later this year. Virginia Ashbery's voice will sound familiar to Life Rattle listeners. She took over the helm of Life Rattle Radio when co-founder Arnie Achtman died in 2005. Her loyalty, determination, and energy kept Life Rattle on the air. In tonight's show, you'll have the pleasure of listening to her stories. Arnie Achtman said Ashbery writes in direct, accessible language. Her stories show a shrewd observation of human behavior and a fine balance of toughness and tenderness. Ashbery's beautifully crafted writing doesn't pull any punches. Her honest observations, presented without fanfare, cut like a knife. In the stories we present tonight, our narrator, smart and strong-willed, has made it through the horrors of childhood, only to find that the cruelty has escalated. In our first story, we find a teenager struggling to survive and to escape an intolerable reality. Let's listen now as Virginia Ashbery reads her story, Jasmine Tea, tonight on Life Rattle. Please note, tonight's stories contain intense and disturbing subject matter. Parental discretion is strongly advised.
Jasmine Tea by Virginia Ashbery. I regained consciousness at exactly 10 a.m. October 8th, 1969, sitting in the second row, fourth seat back of Miss Singleton's grade 12 typing class. The bell that just rang, signaling the beginning of the second period, brings me back. At the front of the class, Miss Singleton minces back and forth from her desk to the blackboard, making precise notations of page and exercise numbers for the next hour. Around me, students flip through texts and load sheets of paper into their typewriters. Sounds come muffled, like they're seeping through a wall. Looking down, I see my hands in my lap, typing text closed and no paper in my typewriter. A wave of fear shudders through me. How did I get here today? Why does no one around me see that I've been gone? My heart speeds, pounding in my ears, blocks out what little sound was filtering in. I sweep the room with my eyes, trying to make connection with anyone, but no one sees me. Miss Singleton's voice cuts into me, slow and loud and near. "Virginia, if you don't want to do exercise 3, maybe you could try number 4. She stands beside my desk, opening my text, folding the pages back, and pushing down on the center spine. The middle finger of her right hand traces back and forth along the title line on the open page while she taps an impatient tattoo on the floor with the long wooden pointer stick in her other hand. Taking a small step backward, she spins with surprising grace and returns to her desk at the front of the class. I am here. I'm not invisible. Fear that I may go away again, maybe forever, gives me the strength to move. I close my textbook, drop it into the open school bag at my feet, then stand up, pick up my purse, and slip the strap over my shoulder. Miss Singleton backs towards the blackboard, holding the pointer across her chest, and stammers, "Yes, yes, Virginia, do you need something?" I walk wordlessly toward her, then turn to the door. "Are you going to the bathroom? Oh, okay, go ahead." Out in the hall, I turn right, down the south steps to the first floor. In the empty hall, my footsteps bounce back to me off gray terrazzo floors and glossy light green cinder block walls. I go directly to the guidance office, walk through the door, and drop into a chrome and orange plastic chair that sits at right angles to the secretary's desk. Hugging my purse to my chest, I say nothing and stare forward. "Do you have an appointment?" asks Mrs. Carr. I stay silent. "Virginia, do you..." She starts again, but the phone interrupts. She listens briefly, then hangs up and goes to the PA microphone. Peter Woods, please come to the guidance office immediately. A few minutes later, Mr. Woods comes, red-faced and puffing, into the room through the door that joins the guidance office with the main office area. He nods at me, then at his office. I follow him in and sit in the one chair placed in front of his desk, my purse still clutched in my arms. He closes the door. Peter Woods was posted to Vincent Massey Collegiate in January last year. He's a big teddy bear of a man who loves to talk about his kids, his wife, and his garden. He wears the same brown tweed jacket every day, with pockets that bulge and sag from his habit of walking the halls with his hands shoved deep into them. We joke with each other in an easy way that I've never had with a man. Once, I reached out and straightened the collar at the back of his shirt, and he thanked me. He will rescue me. He will grab my arm and pull me out of the water I'm spinning in, where up is down. He will save me like my dad did 7 years ago at the beach the summer before he died. "I hear you left class suddenly. You kind of scared Miss Singleton." "I think I have to. I can't," I stutter, looking down. "What's wrong, Virginia? Is there something wrong at home?" he asks. My head jerks up, our eyes meet, and I see that he knows. "I can't go home again," I start, then stop. "It's at night. My stepfather, he comes into my room. He touches me." Mr. Woods stiffens his shoulders, his hands pressed flat on the desk. "He says he's going to rape me as soon as I turn 18. He says I can't stop him then." Mr. Woods pushes himself to his feet with his palms still flat on the desk. "I want you to stop now," he says. "I don't think I'm the one you should be talking to about this." My eyes fill with tears and my vision blurs as I stare down at his hands on the desk. "I just don't think you should tell me this. You have to see me every day in the halls. It would be too uncomfortable for you." He stands up, takes a step back, and shoves his hands into his pockets. "Don't worry, Virginia. I'm going to call someone at the board office. They have special counselors there. That's who you should be talking to. I'll arrange it and let you know when." I get up to leave. "Don't worry. I'll let you know before the end of the day," he calls after me. But I'm already into the hallway, amid the crush of students changing classes. Later that day, in English class, the teacher slips me an envelope with a short note telling me I will be meeting with a counselor next Tuesday at 11 in the guidance office. The week drags. I keep my head lowered to laundry baskets, the stove, and sinks full of dishes. At school, I don't see Mr. Woods even once. On Tuesday, I go to the guidance office. Mrs. Carr is not at her desk. Mr. Woods' office's door is open. A young man sits at the desk. He stands and motions me in. "Hi, I'm Mike Carson. I'm from the board office. You must be Virginia." "Yes." This man looks no more than 5 years older than me. His nervous hands smoothed the front of his soft, mossy green suit jacket. It looks new. We both sit down, and then he takes a long piece of ruled paper out of a brown leather folder. He reads out in point form what he already knows, what Mr. Woods didn't want to hear. He clears his throat and asks, "Is there anything else you want to add? Maybe something you weren't comfortable telling Mr. Woods?" I look down at my hands, then begin touching my fingers one at a time. First the left hand with the right, then the right hand with the left, like I'm counting them, making sure they're all still there. Keeping my head bowed, but in a clear, steady voice, I tell him about 5 years of being touched and groped by Nick, my stepfather, every day, every single chance he gets. I tell him how I can't walk upstairs if anyone is behind me without a cold sweat beating on my forehead because I'm expecting a hand thrust between my legs. I tell him how it felt staring down the double barrel of a shotgun, calm, wondering if I would see the bullets come at me. I tell him how after Nick punched me in the face, my mother made me scrub at big puddles of my blood while I tried not to drip any more on the carpet. I tell him how my mother knows everything, but has made it clear she will not leave him or help me go. She says Nick wants me there, and she wants his wages. I pause, swallow, adding, "If I do not leave home soon, I think I will go away in my mind." "Go away?" "Yes," I say, glancing up at him, then again down to my hands. "Last week I woke up in class. I didn't remember anything, for at least maybe 2 weeks. Nothing." I trail off. This time, when I peek up at Mr. Carson, he's looking down at his hands, fiddling with his fingers too. Our eyes meet. His jaw twitches. His left hand flees to his pen. He makes short notes in clear, rounded handwriting on another long sheet of lined paper that he places in his folder, which he drops into his briefcase as he stands. I get up as well. I will be back next Tuesday at the same time with some idea of what help the board can give you, he says, then quickly, "Don't give up hope, please, and let Mr. Woods know if there are any changes in what's going on at home, like if it gets worse. This isn't really something that the school board gets involved with, but we will try to help you." Mr. Carson starts to hold out his hand for me to shake, but then pulls it back, makes a fist, and shoves it in his pocket. He leads me to the door, stands well back, and I slide into the flow of the crowded hall. Next Tuesday, when I get to the guidance office, Mr. Carson is waiting by the secretary's desk. He ushers me into Mr. Wood's office, motions for me to sit, but stays standing. "I have to ask you something now, Virginia. This is very serious." He shifts his weight right, then left. "We may be able to help you get out of the home, but we must be sure that this is what you want. The people who can make the arrangements must be sure of your resolve. Your parents could cause a lot of trouble if you changed your mind. Don't take this as pressure, but..." "Yes," I interrupt. "Please, if you can, yes, I have to leave." "Okay, then. I'll need you to come with me today. I've arranged to have you interviewed for a group home." "Can I go get my things? I haven't packed, but there's not much," I say, standing up, taking a step toward the door. "I'm sorry. Oh, no, Virginia. We're just going for an interview. There will be 3 people there. They have to see if you're right for the house." I hold my lower lip tight in my teeth, staring at the knot of his tie for a long moment, then sit back down, and he sits too. He pulls out another long sheet of paper from his brown folder. "There will be Sister Anne, the house head, Father Francis, and 1 member of the board of directors. They will ask you some difficult questions. You have to be very honest, like you were with me. They need to hear why you have to leave home. If they accept you, I'm afraid it could take a while before you actually move in. When we get to the Etobicoke girls' residence, I'm not given a tour of the big Victorian house, but on our way to the back room for the interview, we pass through a living room full of cast-off furniture, a sparse dining room with a huge old oak table surrounded by a dozen mismatched chairs, and a large, shabby kitchen. Mr. Carson hands over his long sheet of notes to the other three adults, who take turns quietly reading his points. The priest, a young man with black curly hair, asks me, "Why do you need to leave home, Virginia?" I look to Mr. Carson, at the priest, then back to Mr. Carson. "You have to tell them in your own words, Virginia," he says. I look directly at the priest and tell him, "My stepfather says he is going to rape me." "That's all we need to know," says the priest. He tells me I will be accepted into the residence 7 weeks later, on December 1st. A bed will come open at that time. They ask if I can wait that long, but it's not really a question, and I agree. On the ride back to school, Mr. Carson tells me he will have to meet with my mother to tell her of the plan. He says she cannot stop me from moving out because I'm 17. But that again, because this is not something that the board usually gets involved with, they want to make sure it's done right and legal. Mr. Carson calls my mother and arranges to come to our house on Thursday night when Nick is at his bowling league. Mom doesn't ask for any details at all. The name of the residence never gets mentioned. She agrees to accept, if not support, my decision. Her only comment is that she does not know why I feel the need to move out, but if I do, well then fine. After she sees Mr. Carson to the door, Mum walks back to where I sit in the living room, stands over me, and declares stiffly, "If you are going to live here for 2 more months, I just ask that you keep your mouth shut about this plan. I don't want Nick to know I had anything to do with it. When you go, I will act as surprised as him. Do you understand?" I nod, get up, and head to my room. "I guess you think you're pretty damn clever," she yells at my back, "telling everybody about what goes on in our house. Don't you have any shame?" That night, my stepfather comes into my room. I wake up with his sour breath on my face as he kneels beside my bed. "Fucking little cunt, you know you want it." His arms are under the sheets, his hands grabbing and thrusting at me. For years I have whined, begged, and wrestled, kicking, wiggling back to the wall, shoving where I think his face is, till he would give up, grumble, and stagger back to my mother's bed. This week I've said the words out loud. I don't have to be quiet. Get out of my room. Mum, Mum, make him get out of here, I yell over and over, loud as I can. And I kick, not just to make him go, but to hurt him. My fist hits his nose. He grunts in pain. I scratch the darkness. I want to mark him, to make it seen. "What the hell is going on in here?" Mum demands at my door. But she does not turn on the light. "You," she spits at him. "You, get back to bed now." Nick gets up slowly and staggers out the door, pretending confusion. "And you," she growls at me, "shut your mouth. The neighbors will hear everything. Is that what you want? Christ." She turns away, back to her room, leaving my door open. I hear nothing from their room. He comes to my room a few nights later, and again I yell. Mum hisses at him and me. "This is going to stop now. I will not be dragged out of bed every night for this bullshit." For the next week, nighttime attacks stop, but Nick still gestures, grabs, and rubs against me whenever he can. "Get in here and make a pot of tea," Nick yells to me from the kitchen after dinner on Saturday. I start to rise from my chair in the living room, knowing he will sit at the kitchen table and grab at my nipples as I reach for the teapot, or watching the doorway, come up behind me and rub hard against me. Sometimes he waits till I glance at him. Then he sticks his tongue out just a little and runs it along his thin, leering, and wet lips. That hurts more than his touch. My mother is already standing. "I'll get his tea. You sit down," she hisses. "You stay away from Nick. I don't need any more visits from your school." "What's wrong with the little bitch? Tell her to get off her fat ass and get in here," Nick demands as Mum walks into the kitchen. "I can make you a pot of tea, can't I? I am your wife, aren't I?" "Never mind," I hear his chair scrape, the fridge door open, and beer bottles rattle. On November 11th, we have a holiday from school for Remembrance Day. My mother has told me to get all the washing and ironing caught up on my day off, but I go out with friends and get home late for dinner. Mom's so pissed off she's told Nick about my plan to leave. As I walk through the door, she's on me, screaming, pushing me toward my bedroom. She shoves me from behind down the hallway. I trip and fall to one knee. She grabs my hair and pulls me up, then shoves me again, and I stumble through the door into my room. Get out, you little bitch. You're so goddamn grown up, so goddamn smart, you can get out tonight, right now. Scooping my clothes out of drawers, she throws them onto the floor. Can I get a suitcase? I whisper. She starts yelling again, repeating how if I'm so big, I can manage on my own. Then exhausted, she heads back to the living room and drops into a chair. Nick sits in the middle of the sofa, a big grin on his face, and a beer in his right hand, and a glowing cigarette in the other. Tipping his head back to guzzle the last half bottle, the lamp to his left spotlights greasy wisps of comb over on his scalp. He jerks forward, slams the empty heart on the coffee table. Letting go, he makes a fist, slowly, over and over. If I don't get out of here very fast, before he has another beer, his grin will turn to a sneer, then he will get out his rifle. Tonight, maybe he'll have enough nerve to pull the trigger. I go to the basement and find a couple of large old burlap onion sacks, then take them to my room and shove them full of whatever I put my hands on. Slipping downstairs again, I make a breathless call to a friend who I know has a boyfriend with a car. She tells me he'll need money for gas. I have $2 and change on my dresser. That'll have to do. It's been 15 minutes since I walked in the house, and I'm ready to leave now forever. I drag the sacks down the hall, out the front door, and down to the end of the driveway, just as a skinny, long-haired guy who must be 17 but looks 14 drives up. My friend Connie sits in the passenger seat. The back seat has been removed and an old gray army blanket thrown over the exposed metal. I toss in the sacks, crawl in after, and tell them the address on 7th Street. I don't talk at all during the drive, and Connie doesn't say anything beyond asking for the money for gas. She doesn't introduce me to our driver, but keeps looking sideways at him. The trip takes less than half an hour. When I get out of the car with my bags, Connie looks over her seat at me where I stand outside the driver's side back door. She gives a little wave and asks if I'll be at school tomorrow. I tell her I don't know, but maybe. Her boyfriend keeps staring forward, then looks at her, says they have to go now. I close the door and they pull away. Dragging the sacks up the steps to the front door, I stand there terrified. At the interview, Sister Anne made it plain that my move-in date would be December 1st. I ring the doorbell. The door opens and I'm greeted by a happy, round face. I cry. Great, gulping, wet sobs. I can't catch my breath. The lady I'll later know as the house mother called Marnie picks up my bags, tosses them into the entranceway, then takes my arm and gently leads me to the kitchen. "Oh my," she croons, I don't think I've ever had this effect on anyone. She starts laughing with such honest humor that it makes my tears stop, but I still fight to catch my breath. You must be Virginia. We hadn't expected you so soon or with such drama, but it's a pleasure to meet you. I'll just make a cup of tea, shall I? I am directed to a chair in what is now a brightly lit kitchen with blue cupboards, red gingham tablecloths, and rich smells of dinner. I can't believe I ever thought it was a shabby kitchen. Marnie introduces me to five other girls, Lydia and Debbie at the sink, washing dishes, then Yvonne, Pauline, and Julie making sandwiches. I think we can find her a little corner to move into. What do you think, eh, girls? Marnie beams. Yeah, sure, she can have the spare bed in my room, says Pauline, bent over double and half submerged in the refrigerator. Marnie places a mismatched teacup and saucer in front of me and begins to pour. As the light, yellow, steaming liquid streams into my cup, a tiny golden flower pops out of the spout and unfolds. I squeak in surprise. Marnie laughs again. Oh, it's okay, dear. I should have warned you. This is jasmine tea. I don't look up. I want to breathe the perfume and watch this flower float forever.
That was Virginia Ashbury reading her story, Jasmine Tea. The hopefulness of our narrator makes tonight's second story more heartbreaking than the first. Let's listen now as Virginia Ashbury reads her story, The Visit.
The Visit by Virginia Ashbury. I stand in the front window of the Etobicoke girls' residence, framed by the shabby drapes, watching for my mother to arrive. The day is cold. I can hear, almost feel, the crunch of her car tires on the driveway as she pulls up. She glances up at me, then busies herself with her purse, my cue to hurry up. My roommates have helped me dress, loaning a blouse, skirt, and boots to make a cool but acceptable look to impress my mother and stepfather. A quick glance at the girl in the mirror, then I throw Lydia's crocheted cape over my head and hurry out to the car. I slide onto the front seat, glad for the warmth of the heater. Mum stubs her cigarette out with nervous stabs at the ashtray, then backs out. On the trip home, she talks about neighbors and friends invited to the party, nervously filling the silence. Her head shakes with its familiar sharp spasms, a residual symptom from a childhood illness. My brothers and I can always tell when Mum has reached her limit. Her twitching head acts like an anger barometer. I don't respond with news of my own life, not wanting to break the spell of the moment. Years have passed since she talked to me, not at me, so I just make little ums and oh yeahs to keep her talking. It feels good allowing myself to hope that a month apart has made her miss me, want to fix things. On Hardwick Court, the December sunset outlines the sameness of the 60s subdivision. One street, 70 houses, three different floor plans, and no trees taller than 10 feet. Mum parks behind my stepfather Nick's new white Pontiac. I hug my cape tight against the increasing cold and hurry into the house after her. I meet the familiar smell of cooking, old worn carpet, cigarettes, and beer. As I bend over to unzip my boots, Mum snaps at me to keep them on. I stand up, confused. Why did you wear that cape? She demands. You wore it just to spite me, didn't you? It's Lydia's. She loaned it to me. Everyone's wearing them. What do you mean? You wore that so the neighbors will think you're pregnant. You want to ruin us on this street, don't you? This is your idea of a joke. No, everyone's wearing them at school. I can hear myself whine and hate it. Well, here, put this on. She thrusts her own coat at me. Put this on and walk up and down the street out front a couple of times. I want those bastards to stop their tongue wagging. They think they're so smart, bastards. She spits in a low snarl. When the others get here for the party, they'll see too. I know what they're saying. You leaving sudden like you did. They're all laughing behind my back, saying you're in trouble. So that's it. The overture isn't for the benefit of our relationship. No first step toward healing. I feel colder than the sidewalk. No tears, just cold. In an even voice, I say simply, no. Our eyes meet. She sees my resolve and backs down. Well, obviously you don't care what people think, but I do. They'll see you at the party anyway, she says, walking into the kitchen. I don't follow. Entering the L-shaped living room dining room with its worn-out wall-to-wall carpet, I see Nick in his usual spot on the sofa. This surprises me. He hadn't included himself in the assault at the door. Like a scrawny Buddha, he sits with intense composure. A leer on his face tells me he feels in control, empowered by the exchange he's overheard. Hank Snow drawls out a tune on the stereo. Nick's cigarette package, lighter, and ashtray are lined up in a neat row on the coffee table within his reach. He swings an empty beer bottle by the tips of his fingers between his widely spread legs. Under his stare, I move toward the chair that matches the sofa. Before I can sit, Nick takes the beer bottle in his right hand and slams it down on the coffee table. Get me a beer, he demands. I sit. Get me a fucking beer. No, I say in a whisper. Do you think you're too good to get me a beer? You think you're so big you can take off and that makes things different? Well, you're wrong. Get in that kitchen and get me a beer, bitch. The sleeves of his plaid shirt are rolled up to the elbow. He leans forward, gripping his knees with his hands. The tight ropes of muscles and tendons in his forearms bulge, tense. He's ready. This is not new. I get up and go into the kitchen. My mother is at the sink. I know she's heard every word. He wants me to get him a beer, I say to my mother in a tone that makes it clear I will not. So it'll kill you to do it. Just a few more steps and I'm back to the front door, ready to leave, then gone. My visit has taken me only 15 or 20 steps around the circle of the living room, dining room, and kitchen, less than 10 minutes.
That was Virginia Ashbury reading her story, The Visit. That concludes Life Rattle number 1249. My name is Lori Callis. Arnie Ackman recorded Virginia reading her stories. Life Rattle was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman. Tune into Life Rattle next Thursday to hear more classics by Virginia Ashbury.